Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, and welcome to Inside Scoop Live. Thanks so much for tuning in today. I'm your host, Juanita Watson, and I have invited author, educator, international speaker, and editor, Dr. Andrew Vidich, to the program to talk to us about his new book, Light Upon Light, Five Master Paths to Awakening the Mindful Self. Dr. Vidich has been an adjunct assistant professor of religion at Manhattan College in Riverdale, New York, and at Iona College in New Rochelle. He is also a senior advisor and history chair at the Repertory High School for the Theater Arts in New York City. Dr. Vidich holds degrees in music, comparative mythology, and religion, as well as his PhD in religion from Bernelli International Graduate School. He is a founding member of the Interfaith Council of New York and a member of the Council of Trustees of the Temple of Understanding, which is an international interfaith organization. His consulting firm, the Leadership Institute, teaches and trains people in conflict management, leadership skills, and contemplative practice in educational, corporate, and not-for-profit organizations. Dr. Vidich is a member of the Board of Directors and Public Relations Coordinator for the Science of Spirituality Meditation Center in Amityville, New York. He has been studying meditation for 35 years under the guidance of three world-renowned meditation masters, and he is the author of Love is a Secret, which was published in 1994. And that is quite a bio. So welcome to the program, Dr. Vidich.
Glad to be here.
Wonderful. Well, I have to say congratulations on getting your second book published. It's very inspiring and very heart-centered and very timely, I would have to say.
Thank you.
Yeah.
I'm happy with that.
Yes. So it's been almost 15 years since Love is a Secret. How did Light Upon Light come to be in that time?
Actually, the idea of it came out of a series of talks that I gave at the holistic university in New York City called Open Center. And out of that idea, basically out of those talks, I thought that there was a seed of a new book. And then it kind of, one thing, as you know, leads to another.
So you're exploring the lives of five spiritual masters in this book and their deep personal spiritual quests that at some point they all lead to what's considered a rebirth. So would you actually describe what a spiritual rebirth or awakening actually is?
The term rebirth, awakening, or sometimes in the Christian tradition called born again, you might say, it's really a moment where one enters into a new relationship with themselves as spirit and also usually a spiritual master or teacher in some very direct sense, sometimes called initiation or baptism, diksha in different traditions. But it's another way to kind of understand it is it's a big turning point or step forward. The soul or the aspirant really enters into a spiritual dimension of their life that they haven't really experienced before. They move away from purely outer practices to an inner directed relationship. That's kind of a general idea, but it varies slightly, but amazingly similar in most traditions.
And is this something that someone has to be searching for or consciously seeking?
Normally that's the case, and normally it's something that one enters into very consciously. There are exceptions to that case in various different traditions where initiation or baptism is given without the person really being particularly conscious that it's even happening. And it's an experience of illumination, inner illumination and contact with this divine power or God into expression power. And it does happen on some occasions, but that is really the exception rather than the rule. The general rule is that one seeks quite intensely and for significant periods of time, and and is guided to a teacher who then establishes this much more formal relationship, and a gift is given. Some very powerful gift of spirituality is infused into the disciple or the seeker.
Through finding a relationship with a teacher?
Well, the relationship is established specifically by the spiritual master giving the gift of what we call this inner light and music of spheres, this ringing radiance, which is this, you can, different traditions have called it different things. In the Christian tradition, it's called the Word. It's also called Logos. It's called the light of God, and also in the Old Testament. What it really is the God into expression power, not God absolute, but the expression of God as spirit in the form of light and sound. Sound referring to the inner music or harmony. And so it's an actual trans, literally, transcendent experience, meaning beyond senses. And this is experienced by the inner faculties of the spirit. So it's not a physical phenomenon. It's not nothing to do with your physical eyesight, hearing, taste, touch, or smell. It is the inner eyes and the inner sight that is awakened or actually opened. So it's like, in the same sense that when we are born into this world, all of our five senses are activated almost simultaneously, right?
Mm-hmm.
In the same way, when we are reborn into spirit, the inner senses are activated, and we enter into literally new spiritual worlds as spirit.
I've never heard it put that way. That's fascinating.
Yeah, and it's actually, the interesting thing about it is that the experiences, regardless of tradition, whether they be Christian, Hindu, Jew, or Muslim, the experiences of this awakening of these five inner senses and the experience of this transcendent light and sound and music are all very, very, very similar across all cultures, religions, epochs, and various, and even gender and age.
So you're saying that there, did I hear you correctly, that there's five inner senses?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So how do they correspond then to the outer senses?
Well, in the same sense that you have an inner sense of, an outer sense of seeing, you have an inner sense of seeing.
Mm-hmm.
And this has been referred to as the inner eye or third eye or eye of spiritual perception.
Mm-hmm.
The Sufis call it Nukta Sweta. The Hindus have called it the third eye or Shiva Netra or the eye of Shiva.
Mm-hmm.
Each tradition, the Theosophists have called it the tenth door. So have the different traditions. So it is an actual awakening of this inner perception that occurs that we enter into this. Many of the near-death accounts actually refer to this experience, not knowing that they're talking about the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
But and that's kind of some of the exceptions to the rule, where one is not necessarily formally initiated, but one enters the one's inner perceptions or inner faculties of sight and hearing, taste, touch, and smell are awakened. And in the same sense, hearing. And normally what one sees in the beginning is various different types of illumination, ranging from inner colors of red or green or purple or blue to gold and ultimately to brilliant, brilliant sunlight, much more brilliant than the outer sun at full moon. And also, in some cases, simultaneous to that, rapturous inner harmonies of bells and symphonic sounds and flutes, all kinds of things. And again, these are approximations. Remember, they're that I'm comparing that experience to outer sounds we're familiar with, but
mm-hmm.
they're really not those sounds. They're just a familiar bridge for us to understand that. So the soul has this, literally, again, transcendent experience. That's where that term really comes from.
That is so interesting. So with the five senses that we consider when we hear the word senses, they are very physical, and I would think very, very much attached to our brain, you know, our thinking self. So
mm-hmm.
those inner five senses, where are they attached to?
Well, exactly. It's a good point. So in the same sense, as one enters into this new world, one comes to the realization that we have more, that we are multisensory beings.
Mm-hmm.
We just don't know we have these. They are already hardwired in us. Those inner senses work through the subtle inner body. So we have an outer physical body, but we also have an astral body, where we work through the astral plane, and we have a causal body where we work through the causal plane. So it's just like if you were to go to the moon, you cannot live on the moon in our physical bodies, right?
Mm-hmm.
We need to put on a spacesuit so that we can adapt to the conditions of that place, right?
Mm-hmm.
So as spirit, in order to live in these higher spiritual dimensions, we work through different subtle bodies that are much more refined than the physical body. So we need the physical body to work in the physical plane. We use the astral body to work in the astral plane, and we use the causal body to work in the causal plane. These are like vehicles that the soul or spirit uses to function in these different, if you want to use more scientific language, vibratory arenas or dimensions. And those senses work through those bodies in the same sense that the physical body.
What is the causal body? I've never heard of that.
Okay, so the causal body, the physical body is pretty easy, right? It's,
mm-hmm.
made of, it's matter.
Mm-hmm.
And you have to understand that both matter and energy are really the same. It's just, so these are really just various levels of vibratory energy. That's
mm-hmm.
all they are.
Mm-hmm. Different density.
But when they get to a certain level, they change dramatically in the same sense that water changes into ice, right?
Right.
Or ice into steam. At a certain level, there's a dramatic shift, right?
Mm-hmm.
But all of it is energy. So it's just a shift in the in the status or the state of that particular energy. So the astral body is the body of emotions, normally associated with emotions, but very, very fine emotions. And it's a world in which there's a great expanse of awareness and a great expanse of understanding. Souls are all connected to one another there. The limitations of time and space are automatically. In the causal body, often called the seed body, the soul is covered by a very, very thin film, and or a kind of thin, the best thing would be, membrane, which is its own thought form that are attached to it. But when we say seed, we mean seed. We mean thoughts that are very, very fundamental to who we think we are, or that have encased themselves around us as who we are. In other words, we identify with those thoughts as who we are. And so that's the seed body. And it's, again, an area, it's a world in which the dimensions are even much, much, much finer, much vaster.
Mm-hmm.
And another way to look at the analogy is that as we move inward spiritually, consciousness, it continues to expand, refine, and accelerate in vibratory energy and level until it reaches what it really is, which is light.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So we are really light. That's who we are. The consciousness is light. But
right.
If you put consciousness can, because of its omnipresence, it can enter into anything, become identified with that, and work through that vehicle. But it doesn't mean that it is that.
Fascinating. So one of the core messages in your book is meditation. So how does meditation tie into these three bodies that you're talking about?
Wonderful question. And it's very simply, meditation is the vehicle or the technology. It's the practice that allows us to enter into these higher consciousness aspects of our being. And it's in the same sense that we have all kinds of technologies, for example, telephone and iPods and all these different things that allow us to communicate over long distances, right?
Mm-hmm.
We don't realize that all of these technologies that we're using are really based on very sound science. There are airwaves. In the airwaves, there are all kinds of frequencies that we connect with, right?
Mm-hmm.
And when you broadcast this show out, you're going to be broadcasting out on a certain frequency, which is then going to be picked up by different radio stations, et cetera, or different bandwidths that are broadcasting at that length. So what happens is, in order to enter into these dimensions, we need to attune ourselves to those channels. So meditation is you could call it the attunement device. It's the way that we raise our level of consciousness so that we can enter into these higher vibratory areas. And there's a few preconditions for it, but essentially that is what the whole practice is. It's a method of reconnecting with these higher energies and consciousness that is already within us. And it's present in all traditions, called by different names and things, but unless we actually enter into that relationship with spirit, we're not really divinizing ourselves. We're not really in a spiritual relationship. And I'm not using that to put down anybody. I'm just saying the spirituality arises as we enter into those higher consciousness levels. So that's what it's all about. And it's that's why it's actually the core practice, the fundamental practice, the practice upon which all other exercises that we do in all traditions, whether it's reading of scripture or reciting of hymns or music or anything else, celebratory, non-celebratory, purificatory or not, aims to take us to that point of reconnection.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the technology to do it.
And you're right. Meditation is a central theme in basically every religious and spiritual tradition. That's amazing. You know, it just kind of brings me to a quote that you have in your introduction. It reminded me what you were just saying. And I did write this down because I think it's so profound. It was a quote from Guru Nanak,
yeah,
saying, "Truth is high, but higher still is true living." And I'd like you to maybe talk about what that means in the context of the greater vision you have for Light Upon Light.
Sure. The whole scope of this book was really intended to get people out of theoretical discussion into practice. In a way, during the time of Buddha, there had people had gotten stuck in debates and in mental gymnastics. Mm-hmm. We're stuck in the mind and not rooted in practice. And so people who spend hours and hours debating issues, talking about things, reading things, but no time spent in actual practice. And so one of the great realizations that at some point we all come to is that practice is much more important than theory. An ounce of practice, my spiritual master, Sanfa Paulson, used to say, is better than a ton of theory. In the way of spirituality, we need to move to integrate the experience in our lives. And that's what that quote Nanak is saying. It's the truth is high, it's very important, but living the truth is even more important. Or to give another example, intellectual understanding is realization is much higher.
Mm-hmm.
That's when you become the message that you are promoting. You're no longer just talking about the message, you're living the message.
Mm-hmm.
It's one thing to talk about truth. It's another thing when you never utter a lie.
Right. And I think you can really tell when someone is in one state or the other.
Right.
Yeah.
Exactly. And you know, what happens usually in the beginning of most spiritual searches is that there's a lot of talk and no action.
Right.
We like to quote scripture to everybody, and we're bombasting each other with scripture and whose scripture is right and all of that. And of course, basically, it's kind of like a baby who's trying to figure out how to learn how to walk, but hasn't really realized that you're not going to learn to walk by talking. You're going to learn to walk by walking. And another way to say it is, you don't learn swimming on dry land. You learn it in water.
And right.
So in the same sense, our spirituality has to manifest through practice. And we have to commit a certain amount of our time and our life to developing that practice. And so that's why you get often a big split in certain times and certain cultures where people don't walk the talk.
Mm-hmm.
And you get this shift toward hypocrisy where people are criticizing everybody but not themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And they're seeing the fault everywhere but not in themselves. And you get a kind of bifurcation, and that's very dangerous.
Do you think a lot of people fall into that when they're on the spiritual path? Like, do you think that's part of it in some way?
I do. I do feel that it's certainly part of every spiritual journey that we begin to shift from critiquing others to critiquing ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
And the more work we do on ourselves, the more we realize how little we need to worry about others. My own teacher, one of the master's teachers in the book, Sandarshan Singh, says in one of his couplets, he says that, I have no time to laugh at the faults of others. I'm too busy laughing at my own.
Oh, wow, that's great.
So, and so there's a shift where we really stop that entirely, but it starts gradually. We really stop it entirely. We begin to realize I've got too much on my own plate to be worried about anybody else's plate. But there's also with that another shift that goes on, and that is to realize that we have no control over others.
Mm-hmm.
We have only a chance to change ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
And through changing ourselves, we can impact others. We can, but only by changing ourselves first.
Mm-hmm.
And by being the message that we seek, as Gandhi said, be the change you seek, be the message you seek, the living embodiment. And that doesn't come right away in our spirituality. You still find a lot of people who, while they're committed to their they're still very interested in, they're still fascinated with everyone else's problems.
It's very much an outward projection.
Yeah, and it is. And
yeah.
But gradually that fascination disappears as one is humbled in one's own journey.
Mm.
And the more humbled we are, the more we realize, hey, I have, and quoting Christ, let's not try to pull out the speck in someone else's eye when we have a mote in our own. And that is really a dramatic turning point. It doesn't happen right away, but it must happen at some point.
Now, is this the ego we're talking about when you really get clear that the ego is there and that it's a huge part of?
Absolutely.
Yeah, yeah.
Absolutely. And one really begins to understand that each and every one of us is wearing different kinds of false perceptions or eyeglasses that are smoky and colored. And those perceptions are skewed. And until we really get clear ourselves spiritually, whatever we see out there is really a projection of our own self. It's really a reflection of who we are.
Mm-hmm.
And therefore, what we're doing is not really critiquing anyone. We're just projecting our own problems. Some traditions go so far as to say that if you see a fault in others, it's only because you still have it in your own self.
Mm-hmm. I've heard that. Do you believe that?
I do.
Mm-hmm.
There is a stage that comes much higher, though, that where one is spiritually pure, and then what one sees is not one's own self, but now one is completely objective and purified of all of one's own issues, and then what one sees is the real truth of their being based upon all of their karmic reactions, and it's a visionary stage. It's not an intellectual perception.
Mm.
So it is a state of vision. It has nothing to do with the intellect. The intellect is very limited and extremely prone to error.
Mm-hmm. I imagine it wouldn't, that kind of judgment wouldn't hold as much of an emotional charge, obviously, if you were operating at that higher level.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Mm. It holds no fascination whatsoever. It's just an objective truth that one sees very clearly, but one does not act on. One doesn't, because one also sees it, that there's an objective love that is developed. In other words, there's detachment. And one, instead of seeing that as a problem to correct, one embraces that person as another part of oneself.
Mm-hmm.
And the idea of duality, consciousness, kind of slowly disappears and ultimately submerges as in this unity consciousness, which is really the place where we're all headed.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And the unity consciousness is very different than than the kind of duality consciousness, which is me and myself and everyone else is something different and other, and I can achieve my own happiness at the cost of other people's happiness. It's that world in which we're so isolated, we don't see that everything I do or you do or anyone else does is going to affect everybody else.
Mm-hmm.
But we're still stuck in this small little world. And what meditation does is it expands consciousness so that you see that every thought, word, and deed that we do or I do or anyone does has an effect on everyone. And their thoughts and words affect us as well. And so that we're all in this together. It's not like divide and conquer here.
Right, right. Well, we are living in such a time of duality. Yeah. It's very applicable to what we're seeing today in the world in this crisis point that's happening. And I'd love to hear your thoughts of where we are right now from your perspective.
Well, if you're talking about some of the crises that we're going through right now, I think that they're definitely results of specific parts of our population that have made decisions that were based on selfish motive. And instead of based upon the greater good for everybody. In other words, the realization, what happens is it takes a while for people to live by an inner ethical system.
Mm-hmm.
No law, you know, there's not enough laws you could write that would dictate every situation where people have to act ethically.
Mm-hmm.
And so what happens is you have situations, for example, in a financial crisis that we're in, where people acted inappropriately, There may not have been a specific law against it, but instead of using their intuition on how this could help or hurt other people, they didn't. And they didn't see the connection between their actions and their own selfish greed and agendas, and so it kind of spiraled out of control. And this isn't to place blame on anything, because it's not a single place. There are errors in many, many areas. But these, I think that these global events have a bigger significance than just, I think they get us to realize that everything affects everything, and that we cannot solve these things with the old kind of consciousness that we've been working with in the past, which is, and that capitalism itself has to kind of undergo some changes.
Yes, a radical shift.
And we are making that radical shift. We're moving out of, I think, coming to the realization that greed cannot be a safe way to expand the world, you know, in all cases. It's just not going to work. Unchecked greed just doesn't work.
Yeah, yeah.
And we'll be back with more Inside Scoop Live after these important announcements.
Whether you've already written your manuscript or are contemplating writing one, you will need to create a book proposal. ReaderViews has a coaching service to help you create an enticing book proposal for your work of fiction or nonfiction. In fact, ReaderViews will even submit your book proposal to publishers and agents they have created a relationship with, and then they promise to pursue these submissions. Go to ReaderViews.com today and click on Services for Authors to find out more information on book proposals and how ReaderViews can help you. Thanks for tuning in to Inside Scoop Live. I'm talking today with Dr. Andrew Vidich. His new book, Light Upon Light, is available now, and you can find out more about Dr. Vidich through his website, enlightenbook.com. And it very much, to me, seems like we are right in the middle of going from the separation consciousness to the unity consciousness.
Yes. There's a big shift on many, many different levels, starting with individual people, but then moving to families and then communities and then organizations, institutions, and governments.
Right.
So, yeah, but I think there's also, when we talk about a global shift, I talk about in the book a little bit the fact that the real revolution that we need to have is not an economic, not a political, not a social, but a spiritual one. And that revolution has to be started by each of us realizing our truth and realizing our connection with everything else. Create human beings who are rooted in that higher consciousness, in that higher unity. And until we do that, even if you have good laws, even if you have good intentions, there will always be people who will manipulate the situation to their own advantage. And any system is only as good as the people who are operating in it.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you can have a great system, but if the people are corrupt in the system, it leads to the same problem. So the real answer, and I think this is where we're going, is to spiritualize our culture, our institutions, and our way of life, and get people to think in different ways outside of this notion that, for example, my country can prosper despite all the other countries in the world not prospering.
Mm-hmm.
Or that so long as I'm okay and my family's okay, then it doesn't matter what's happening in the rest of the world.
Yeah.
That kind of just doesn't work anymore.
No.
And will not work.
Mm-hmm.
So that is the gradual shift. And it has to come from a spiritualization. It has to come from seeing that we're all one consciousness.
And I love the way you put it, that the transformation is really going to happen within the heart of each individual.
Yeah, my spiritual master, Don Kapalse, who I talk about quite a bit in the book, had a large, huge impact on me. He said that the spiritual revolution is the revolution that is needed, because this is the power of each of us to affect change from within first. And that when we're really centered in who we are, we don't need words. Our radiation, we can change other people through our radiation. What he meant by radiation is that every thought, word, and deed has a radiating power. And so, therefore, when we are living that truth, and we're talking about that realization aspect, we affect people and they don't affect us.
Mm-hmm.
We give out positive, uplifting radiation, or you can even call it love, if you will, because love is that highest form of radiation, which transforms our environment and transforms our families and transforms our community. And a transformed community transforms the country, and a transformed country will transform the world. Mm-hmm. So we start, you have to start small, but that's where it all starts.
That's the ripple effect. That's the beginning. Mm-hmm. It's so interesting because, you know, when you look at that, it ends up being that you don't have to be consciously and intellectually doing. It's just the state of being that's going to be the transformative effect.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And it's making decisions based upon that higher understanding.
Yeah.
Every thought, every word, every deed either increases joy and happiness in this world, brings light into this world and ourselves, or doesn't.
Mm-hmm.
And so when we're not conscious of what we're even thinking, let alone what we're saying, and most of the time what we're doing, then we're naturally going to make errors and mistakes based upon habituated condition and reactive patterns. We have to break out of the conditioned, reactive, and habituated patterns and become conscious human beings.
Mm-hmm.
And from that point of consciousness, everything can evolve. But if we're just going to be automatons, if we're going to be nothing more than reactive beings based upon previous experiences, then we're just going to continue to repeat again and again and again and again and again all the errors.
Yeah.
On an individual and on a societal and a global level.
Yeah, and headed for a lot of suffering in that way.
Right. The difference now here is, I see it, I mean, if we're talking global here, is that now it's very clear that individual mistakes of a single country affect the whole world.
Good point.
Or individual mistakes and some say the goodwill of a single country affects the whole world.
Yeah.
The goodwill, and so it works both ways, but we can no longer isolate those actions, whether it's in the financial world or whether it's in the political world, or whatever domain it's there.
Mm-hmm.
And in a way, 9/11 was a kind of a big turnaround. I know young adults who were going through that period of time all of a sudden woke up and said, who didn't know where Iran or Iraq was, didn't know what Islam was, all of a sudden woke up the next morning saying, hey, you know, I've got to find out where I'm living in this world.
Yeah, it seems like 9/11 was that pivotal moment of change,
mm-hmm.
and it's just been basically unfolding from there.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, yeah. So you, in your book, at the end of each chapter, you have a list of questions, basically exercises. So these are areas that people can go to start transforming some of that thought, that ego thought, into a more spiritual direction.
Exactly, and it's a way to begin a kind of self-coaching. Just like in any field, in any endeavor, we need to monitor how we're doing. Whether it's in finance or whether it's in education, we need to assess ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
We need to see how we're doing. We need to analyze what we're doing right, and we need to analyze what we're doing wrong. We need to make adjustments as we're going. So these exercises help us understand where are we going wrong, and what can we do to alter or change that direction? And they're really meant to, there's something that should be done on a daily basis. These are exercises, just like we should meditate every day. That's part of the things that I talk about. There are many, many things that we need to do to monitor ourselves and our own behavior. And these hopefully will provide some insight into, you know, starting that kind of a practice.
Mm-hmm. Now, getting back to meditation for a minute, what is your recommendation for a daily meditation practice?
Well, it depends on your background, and it depends on how much free time one has, of course. But generally, I suggest, on an average, to start, does not mean end, but start with 10 or 20 minutes a day. Usually start in the morning. That practice can be increased to much, much more, depending upon one's lifestyle and various other factors and the degree of commitment. But unlike certain, I think, previous exponents of meditation, I don't think meditation is not something you do just for 20 minutes.
Uh-huh.
What we're really trying to understand is that meditation is a vehicle to expand awareness exponentially. So it's not like it's like 20 minutes a day is enough. What we're trying to create is a state of awareness 24 hours a day.
Uh-huh.
If it's only going to be there for 20 minutes a day, and then you leave that state of awareness, then it may have a small ripple effect, but it's not going to change your life, really.
Right.
So the idea is that you enter into that place of meditation, you come out of it, you integrate that experience, and gradually, as you deepen our experience of meditation, you're in the contemplative or meditative state 24 hours a day, 7 days a week.
Mm-hmm.
It is only in that place that our consciousness is consciously expanding. So it's 24/7, 365 days a year. That's the whole idea.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
It's not something you do just for 20 minutes. The way I put it for people, to shift their awareness away from the kind of, I would say, dualistic thinking that we normally have, it's just, you know, I'm going to put in 20 minutes a day and let's see what happens, is what we're doing, if we're doing 20 minutes a day, the other 23 hours and 40 minutes is really your practice. The 20 minutes is the fruit of your practice.
Mm-hmm.
So you're sitting down, and in that 20 minutes, you get the fruit in the stillness of what you've done the other 23 hours and 40 minutes. And as that shifts, we gradually shift away. So we begin to see that our real practice is what we do every moment of our life.
Yeah. That's a very different way of looking at meditation.
Exactly. But that is the goal of meditation. The goal is to make every moment a conscious moment. And meditation is about only one thing, expanding awareness, consciousness, illumination, and ultimately love. And if we're not doing that, it doesn't matter the meditation technique you're doing.
Yeah, right.
It's not helping.
Right, right. Do you think the key to getting the full benefits of meditation is consistency?
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay.
I think, again, it's part of the thing I talk about is being consistent about everything we do in our lives, in our practice, sticking with it, making it part of who you are, and that's how it becomes who you are. Just like in the, you get up in the morning, no one has to be told to eat. We eat unconsciously. Mm. We're hungry, we eat.
Mm-hmm.
So no one has to be told to read books. There's an intellectual curiosity. So we do feed our body, we feed our mind, but we don't feed our soul.
Mm.
And meditation is the way that we feed our soul. So the soul, which is consciousness, lives on consciousness, and it must connect with consciousness to expand and to grow.
So wonderful.
That is the only way it's going to grow. It's not going to increase by contact with any of the sensual or sensory phenomena of sight, hearing, taste, touch, and smell. It doesn't matter what it is. We can have wonderful experiences of singing and dancing and the spiritual sense, and those are all wonderful and great, but it's not a replacement for the conscious contact with the spirit within. And as this inner eye opens, see, what happens is that as this eye opens, it doesn't close, so that one now is conscious on two levels. One is conscious using two levels of perception. The inner eye is open, and the outer eyes are open as well. So those people who are very evolved spiritually, they don't even need their outer eyes.
Mm-hmm.
They can see everything through their spiritual eye, and because the spiritual eye goes through matter, they can see beyond physical anything, through walls, through the mind, it is subtly attuned. So, for example, if someone whose inner spiritual eye is open, he can immediately tell what kind of thoughts that person has, because each thought has a color and a radiation and even a smell, which are subtle smells. They can look at that person in 2 seconds and see what's the general makeup of their whole being. Just like you and I open up look at one of those jars, and you see in the jar mango or blueberry, right? You tell right away, what is it? So the human body becomes transparent when the spirit. So when the spiritual eye is open, it gives us tremendous insight into the nature of human beings, but also ourselves.
And we all have the capacity to do that.
Everyone. These are sometimes referred to psychic phenomena, but they come naturally as one progresses spiritually. One doesn't have to ask for these things. These are things that occur naturally and are given if that soul is developed selfless love for others. Until we develop selfless love for others, someone who doesn't have that could look at that and use that in a selfish, egotistical way to benefit themselves.
Yeah, right. It's true.
And that would be, of course, contrary to any of God's laws. Those gifts are only given to people who are consciously working on the planet to better everybody.
Yeah.
And have no personal agendas. They just they love everybody instinctively, intuitively, in the same way that a mother loves her child without any reservation.
So with these masters that you chose for this book, why these five?
One, because they were all great poets, and poetry is a vehicle to express great spiritual truth. That's one. Two, because two of them are very, very well, I would say, very, very well known within certain traditions and have a tremendous reading public right now. One is Rumi, and also because he was one of the greatest spiritual masters in the Islamic and Sufi tradition. Hafiz, because he is an equally great spiritual master of within that tradition that not as many people know. Wanted to introduce him, but he's about, in Iran particularly, he's probably, if you were to compare a literary figure, Shakespeare, he's 10 times more important than Shakespeare is to English reading audiences.
Oh, wow.
If you can get to that level, right?
I had never heard of Hafiz.
Yeah, Hafiz. So he, and he was perhaps one of the greatest, if not one of the greatest, certainly within Persian, the Persian literary world, poets of all times within Persian literary. But is having has had a tremendous amount of effect over the years in a kind of behind the scenes way with many great spiritual teachers and literary figures. So that was one. Then Nanak and Kabir, because they were the two most seminal spiritual revolutionaries at a time in history, which in some ways has comparison to our own moments now, when there is this tremendous conflict between two major religions, or maybe even three or four major religions, Islam and Hinduism in Pakistan and India, and Islam and Christianity in the West. So I think there's no inherent conflict here, but there's this element of fundamentalism or terrorist element that is emerging that was rampant in those days and is also very present now. But those two figures reshape the Indian subcontinent in the same way that Christ reshaped the world in which he lived about 2,000 years ago, shifted it away from a certain understanding of spirituality and shifted it. These people did the same thing in their own time. And also, I think, fundamentally, because they were all, in some very major ways, all very much above sectarianism and any kind of sectarian or dogmatic kind of narrow-mindedness in religion. Had a very universal approach, which is what I think we need today. And I think we've always needed it, but even more today. And then the last one, who is his name is Sundarshan Singh, who in a way, perhaps in a much stronger way than I have emphasized in the book, continues the literary tradition of mystical poetry that started with Rumi and Hafiz and went through a number of Indian poets right up to Ghalib in the 20th century and then the 19th century in Pakistan. He's kind of like the literary heir of that whole tradition, but not too well known here, although in India and the subcontinent, extremely well known. And then lastly, the fifth reason is because they're all considered sant saints from within the tradition that I am embedded. And a sant saint is simply those saints who have come, despite, here's the interesting point, despite religious outer garb, pointed to a universal transcendent reality that transcended sectarian borders or sectarian limitations. So they all had those that special quality of universalism.
I think it's a great pick. I mean, these five that really, really are amazing. You know, a book like this, you know, you kind of answered my question, but, you know, I would think that some people may wonder why studying spiritual luminaries that may have lived in a completely different time or in a very different culture, how that could actually, studying about them actually helps them in their day-to-day struggle. You know, someone living in some town or city in the U.S., how studying these people would help them?
Right. Well, that's a legitimate question. The book takes those five, but it uses them as really a springboard. And one of the themes or the underlying themes of the book is that we all need spiritual guidance and that spiritual guidance is not for the few, it's for everybody.
Mm-hmm.
That those people who are spiritually hungry and spiritually thirsty, there is water and there is food for the spiritually thirsty and hungry. And that God does not leave the world barren. And so each of us needs to find that spiritual guidance in our own lifetime. So while these great masters certainly can provide the blueprint, the book strongly underscores the need for guidance in whatever climate, whatever time or place that we are, and to continue our search. And it actually leaves, the last chapter actually gives a short kind of introduction to a current spiritual teacher who is alive and living today, who people can check out.
Mm-hmm.
So it doesn't, it leads you to, hopefully the book leads you to a place to go for further guidance. At least, if nothing else, I hope the book opens the door for people to continue to open up and to seek guidance spiritually, because it is one of the cardinal important principles. Spirituality is not something we do on our own. We need guidance. We need community and guidance both. And all of the saints who are depicted in the book all talk about guidance as an incredibly important part of the journey, getting that guidance. The important thing here to understand is that the spiritual master, the spiritual teacher, doesn't give us anything we don't already have. All they do is awaken it.
Mm-hmm.
So they're not higher than us. They are the same as us, but they have awakened what we have in us, and through being in their company, we get the gift of that awakening.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's back to that idea of initiation, which takes us back to the beginning of the interview, which is they can give gratuitously that experience as a free gift, and which is the opening of our own consciousness. And it's not, this is not within the religious domain. It's a spiritual reality that anyone can have, doesn't matter who they are.
Mm-hmm.
So that's, hopefully, and that's really where the book ends up, for people to continue to work on their spiritual lives, to move in that direction, and find the guidance in the community that is going to, you know, propel them forward.
And you don't have any kind of agenda as to where people go for that, you know. And I love that about this book. You know, you are just encouraging people to follow their own truth, their own path.
Yeah, absolutely. I don't think, first of all, no, it would be totally presumptuous on me or anyone else to assume that I know where the best place for everyone to go is. That is something that's really, and here's the irony of ironies, is that it's not we who decide. It's not the seeker who finds the thought. It's the thought who finds the seeker. And as it says in one of the Hindu traditions, it says when the disciple is ready, the guru appears.
Yeah.
So it is a question of readiness.
Mm-hmm.
And in our tradition, we believe that God is guiding everybody.
Mm-hmm.
Some are more aware of the guidance. Some are totally oblivious to it. Some don't even know God exists, but God is still guiding them.
Right, right.
Whether they acknowledge it, that power is still guiding them and still moving them in their own best interest spiritually. There comes a point when we see consciously that guidance.
Yeah.
And then God makes the arrangements. No human being can do it. Mm. God makes the arrangements.
There has to be a certain level of surrender.
Right, there has to be a certain level of a certain level of surrender, a certain level of readiness, a certain level of depth of understanding, and a certain level of discrimination that one has developed, that one is now ready to enter into that relationship. And all you can do, and this is what my master said, is just pray for God's guidance and check out different spiritual teachers. And that's all you can do. You can't ask for anyone to do anything more than that.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
You know, Rumi says that, listen, if you haven't found a guide, continue looking, and basically he says, continue looking wherever you go, and imagine that wherever you go, that there is a hidden saint in everyone.
Oh, that's beautiful.
It's a beautiful way of looking at it.
Yeah, yeah. That's a very different way of looking at who we are and our experiences. Mm-hmm. Very different way.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's great. Well, I think on that note, I am going to have to end this interview. I wish I just had all afternoon to talk with you today.
Well, it would be lovely to continue. And I just don't know if you're going to put this on, but you're welcome to put the enlightenbook.com where they can get the book if they want to.
Yes, no, let's mention your website. So enlightenbook.com and then your business website is leadershipinstitute-inc.com.
Right. Exactly, leadershipinstitute-inc.com. You can put that on there too.
Okay, great. No, we definitely want to mention your website. I know that your book, can it be purchased through your website, or do you suggest?
Yeah, well, you can purchase it through the website, the Enlightened Book. It just clicks you right to Amazon. And
okay.
You can also purchase it directly on my business consultant website as well.
Okay, great.
You can get it either, and one is just about the book, the other is the other stuff that I do.
Is a lot of, yes, and you do many, many things, not just write books. So we definitely encourage listeners to go to both websites because you have a very interesting path and career. So I really encourage people to check you out and check out this book. I mean, it really is wonderful, Dr. Vidich.
Thank you so much.
Yes.
Appreciate the opportunity to speak with you today.
Yeah, it's been wonderful, and I hope to be able to talk with you again and have you back maybe when you have your third book. Are you in?
Okay.
You got any in the works?
Yes, we do. There's another book coming out.
Okay.
Hopefully.
Okay, good. Well, I have a feeling we're going to talk again then.
Okay. Denise, it's been a great joy, and thank you so much for your time.
And thank you, too. You take care.
Yeah.
All right, listeners, that's been Dr. Andrew Vidich, his new book, Light Upon Light, 5 Master Paths to Awakening the Mindful Self. It is out now. And I will mention his website once again, enlightenbook.com. And also Dr. Vidich's business website is leadershipinstitute-inc.com. And so please do check both of those out. Wonderful book. I highly, highly recommend it. So once again, thank you so much for listening to Inside Scoop Live. I'm Juanita Watson, and until next time.